Hello and welcome to High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and Joel can't make it for a variety of reasons, but I have special guest Marcus Penn coming on.
Hello.
Hey. This is a little unorthodox. How did you first come across Kurosawa, if you can even remember?
I first came across Kurosawa, I think, like a lot of people, in college during my, like, super film discovery. When I was working on music, I scratch and I do music production, but I do a lot of scratching on a lot of hip-hop records. And in college, this, like, local, like, group, I did the scratches for their album, and the album cover was the image of, like, the Seven Samurai.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, because I spent a lot of time in video stores as a teenager and as a kid, and I was like, oh, that looks familiar. And I was like, what is that from? And then my friend was saying, he was like, oh, that's from Seven Samurai. So, very classic cliche intro in college. Seven Samurai was my introduction. And then, so this was like the early-ish 2000s. And then, like a lot of folks, it was just through the Criterion Collection. But then, you know, after I graduated college, I went to, I moved to New York City, or I guess technically I moved back to New York City. And it's kind of the home of a lot of repertory theater. So, you know, I got to discover the, through, you know, places like Film Forum, Brooklyn Academy of Music, theaters like that, I got to learn about the, you know, non-Criterion Kurosawa mm-hmm. films, you know, at the time. So now that this would have been 2004, 2005, 2006. And, yeah, just from then, I've just been kind of, I mean, he has a lot, you know, he has a lot of films, but, I've seen quite a bit. And, yeah, so just college and just through a friend and just through, like, this iconic image of the Seven Samurai. And just asking, like, I've seen that before, just, like, in being in video stores so much. Like, where is that from? And then that's how it all started.
Oh. Yeah, the usual thing I hear is Star Wars and, like, the classic, oh, George Lucas liked Hidden Fortress.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, that was next. Oh, well, that was next. Because during my discovery, you know, I got the Criterion movies, you know, like the classic ones, like the Yojimbo, Hidden Fortress, etc. And my good friend Dave, who was another turntablist scratch DJ, was the one who broke down. You know, this would have been around 2005. Because I do remember in Hidden Fortress, which is might be top two or three favorite Kurosawa films, you know, the one, you know, how they transition from scene to scene, the way, like, the frame kind of slides over, just like they do in Star Wars.
Yeah.
And I do remember thinking before anyone telling me, like, oh, that does kind of remind me of Star Wars. And then my friend Dave was explaining to me, he was just like, no, George Lucas, da-da-da-da. But then I realized, and not to kind of, like, play my friend, but then I remember, you know, like, on the extra features of the DVD for Hidden Fortress, is that interview with George Lucas, and it shows it, and I just kind of feel like, I think you just saw that and tried to, like, act like you knew it, but I think that's where he got that information from.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So, yeah, so the George Lucas thing was next.
Oh, okay. So, this episode is the second half of our 1947 pairing. They just did, what is it, One Wonderful Sunday, which is... that's a really interesting one that that goes way underrated, and so we're comparing that one Kurosawa with this with Shinichi Taniguchi, his film Snow Trail from 1947, which was the debut film of Toshiro Mifune, and the debut film for Akira Ifukube, who did the music for Gojira, which, if you notice, the soundtrack at certain points sounds pretty similar to Gojira.
Sure.
At least I think some of it sounds pretty
similar. Sure, yeah. No, not now that you say that, definitely. Yeah.
But, yeah, a lot happens, so it is we kind of do have to go through the plot. Let's see. So, it starts out with this montage over credits, which was pretty surprising because I'm so used to old Japanese movies not doing anything over the credits.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Sure, sure. That's a good point. I didn't think about that too. You said it.
Yeah, like over the credits, it's this montage of a crime happening and these three criminals, one played by Takashi Shimura, probably my favorite actor, period, Toshirô Mifune, and someone else whose name I didn't write down. And
I looked him up. Oh, hang on. I just had the Snowchild tab up a second ago here. He actually looked from. I thought he was someone else from an older Japanese actor, but apparently he's not. Yeah. But here, hold on. I have it right here.
okay.
Yeah, the third criminal who. Well, we're getting. Obviously, we're getting spoiler heavy on this. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, the one who. The one who doesn't make it.
It's a movie from the 40s. It's fine to spoil it. It doesn't
Fair
matter.
enough. Yeah, Yoshio Kosugi.
That name doesn't sound familiar.
Yeah, I mean, he. When you go to his Wikipedia, I mean, he has his own Wikipedia page, so I guess he's relevant in some way. But yeah, the character he plays, Takasugi. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel kind of bad for that guy because he started a movie with Shimura and Mifune, and he kind of got completely overshadowed.
Well, overshadowed. I mean, they're too. I mean, again, this is not trying to put you trans. You know, go back in time. This they weren't the Shimura and Mifune that we know. But still, it's one. Yeah, that their performances can kind of overshadow anyone. But also, I mean, he dies what a third into the movie, if that. I mean,
Yeah.
he doesn't even make it into the inn,
Oh no.
scene in the movie. Yeah, so that's another reason too. He's kind of easy to forget. He's the first one to go.
So he's been in stuff like he's in Seven Samurai, but he's only a farmer. But I don't remember him at all in that.
Sure. Yeah, I don't
In
either.
Hidden Fortress, he's just a soldier, and he might be a soldier who's like commanding them when they're in like the mud pit looking for gold. That could be him, but I'm not really sure. And the Men Who Trod on Tiger's Tails, which is, I don't know. I don't remember that one very well because it's kind of Kurosawa's worst.
Which one is this?
Men Who Trod on Tiger's Tails.
Oh, okay.
Have you seen that one?
I haven't. Like I said, he's got a lot of stuff. Yeah, he's a, and he's also someone who
It's an hour.
he's a legend. He's a legend. He's a master, but he's not like a personal favorite of mine. But he's one of those guys. Like, I'm interested in film history and learning about all kinds of. So he's someone that, not to sound this way, but you kind of have to know the classics. You should know about him. But yeah, so a lot. He's one of those filmmakers where a lot of stuff slips through the cracks. But his work spans how many decades? So it's and he works steadily. So
At 50 years, at 43 of
exactly.
93.
Exactly. So,
Yeah, Tiger's Tale is kind of regarded as his probably his worst movie. It's only an hour long, and it's I don't know. There's not really much to it compared to like everything else. Even his propaganda stuff is better. But anyway, so these three criminals, they rob a bank or something. It's not really clear what they rob, but they get a bunch of money and they hide out. And first a hotel, and then the police kind of figure out they're in a hotel, and they move the headquarters to the mountains, and the police are on their way to the mountain to the hotel, and so then the criminals move out to this random shack out of nowhere, and that's when tension starts to build, and you realize oh they don't quite trust each other, and Shimura and Mifune screw over. I forgot the other guy's name already.
Takasugi.
Takashugi, and they steal his money and just and they just leave him there, and they run off. But then the police start to catch up, and I think it's before this, one of the cops says, "Don't fire your gun here; it'll cause an avalanche."
Exactly.
And then But so the third guy, he fires his gun and causes an avalanche, and he
actually, well, I don't mean to cut you off. It should be noted he shoots a dog.
Yeah, but he misses though.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. He does. Okay.
Yeah. I have a dog. I always make sure to pay attention to that.
Right. I just, it's funny, not to divert too much, but I was listening to the Kevin Smith episode of the Joe Rogan podcast, and at two points in that episode, both Joe Rogan and Kevin Smith cry, because they both talk about deaths of, like, their past dogs. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty emotional episode. I was not expecting that, but yeah, so.
Oh, yeah, dogs will always get me in a movie. No sure. matter what. But, right. Yeah, so the dog does not die. It kind of runs off, but causes an avalanche, which kills him, and...
Yeah, Takasugi, yeah.
Takasugi, and so then Shimura and Mifune end up seeing some ski tracks, and the ski tracks lead to this hotel, kind of out in this way-off village. Mm-hmm. And in that hotel, it's this guy named Mr. Honda, who you don't know much about him yet, besides he likes to drink, and when he gets drunk, he dances. There's mm-hmm. a young girl who, I guess, is the granddaughter of the owner.
Yes.
And
yeah, it's grandfather, granddaughter. Yep.
And the grandfather is played by. This character actor from the time who he's in a bunch of Kurosawa stuff. He's pretty much if you watch any Japanese movie from the 40s and 50s and you see a goofy old man, it's usually him.
Yeah, his name Kokuten Kodo. I hope I'm saying his name right.
Yeah, he's in Hidden Fortress, Seven Samurai, No Regrets for Our Youth. He just shows up. Like everywhere, he's in Scandal, a lesser known Kurosawa, and kind of his biggest role where he gets three scenes and actually pivotal to a plot. But, I mean, I like seeing this guy. He's just always plays like a goofy old man, although here he's kind of stern. And so the movie, up until this point, is just kind of not much is happening besides the criminals find a place. And they then run away, but now they just hang out because the avalanche blocked the road, and so they have an excuse to just hang out. But then Mifune's character starts to get all antsy, and he wants to leave, and yeah. Shimura doesn't want to leave. He just wants to relax, and he starts to really connect with the young girl, and you learn that he had a daughter who died at a similar age, so you got that whole thing going on, and they have a and the radio doesn't work, and the carrier pigeon dies, so there's no way of information getting out. But right. then they start work on the road, and they find out Mr. Honda is an expert climber who kind of just like, I guess he's a choreographer or something in the area. And he can climb this huge mountain that apparently only experts can climb. And they decide to... No.
Well, yeah, no, he makes that... And actually, yeah, when Mifune's character, or Ejima, approaches him, he's like, we need you to, you know, guide us and get us out of here. And, like, he's initially just like, no, you guys are amateurs. Because you soon see... Mm-hmm. Later on, we'll finish up the plot that, you know, this kind of hiking through a mountain, it's definitely a team effort, obviously, because they're all attached at the hip, literally. So that's kind of an interesting perspective where it's just like, you can be a pro, but you're still dependent on others, and you and they can still kind of cause your demise, which basically is kind of what happened. But I'm sorry, but go ahead.
That's fine. Yeah. And Mifune threatens him with his gun, and so they sneak out in the middle of the night. They sneak out like way early in the morning, and Mr. Honda decides to go because Mifune says he will kill the little girl if he doesn't take them. And so they climb, and the filming, it looks like the actual actors were climbing the mountain.
In certain parts, especially like far away shots, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's not them, but you know.
Yeah, but.
But they do a good job up close. I mean, I'm pretty sure in some scenes, especially with Mifune, when he's up close holding a rope, it looks like that classic, you know, that Batman and Robin, that Adam West Batman and Robin effect, where they're really, you know, where the camera's just turned, you know.
Yeah.
But still, yeah. It's still believable. It's all believable. It doesn't really look cheap or anything.
Oh, no. It's pretty harrowing at certain points. And I have a... I'm afraid of heights, and so I found that section to be very weirdly tense compared to kind of the rest of the movie. But, so the tensions continue to get worse as they start climbing the mountain, and I stopped taking as many notes here because I was kind of so engrossed with it.
Sure.
But, Mifune decides to take all the money that Shimura has, and so they end up in a fight, and Mifune ends up getting thrown off the mountain, and that's the end of him. And before that, he shoots the Mr. Honda in the leg, and Mr. Honda already has a broken arm, and so then Shimura has to carry him on his back and climb back down from the peak of the mountain.
Right.
And it's just them climbing back down, and the police are there, and Shimura is perfectly okay with just getting arrested.
Yep.
And that's pretty much it. He goes down, he gives himself up to the police, and on the way back, they're on a train, and he says, "Can I just look at the mountain one more time?"
Yeah,
and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, and there is a nice goodbye between the granddaughter, the little girl, and Nijiro as he's being taken away by the police.
Yeah, it's
too.
Yeah, like overall, I found it to be kind of uneven.
Why is that? Why?
Because I don't think you got a good understanding of who the three thieves were in the beginning. And just felt kind of like, they felt like cardboard a little bit. And Mifune, this is Mifune's first film, so he's not, it's not like 50s Mifune where, like, he is in full control of his persona. This is just like an early, this is, you know, and just trying to figure out, like, how to, like, be an on-screen actor. And at times, it's kind of like, oh, he's just kind of standing there. And other times, like, he turns on the charm, and you can't take your eyes off him.
Yeah, and, you know, and that's true, and that's interesting. I mean, this movie's just, it's 89 minutes long, start to finish. So I kind of got the feeling before even starting this, I knew, you know, when movies are only so long, you're only going to get so much, I guess. I do think that the you know, all three, you know, criminals in the film, you do kind of get, I do think they all play their part. It's like Toshiro Mifune, he's the alpha male. He's like the mean one, you know, he's in control. He's the alpha male, but, you know, he's also like the actual villain. Whereas, you know, Shimura's the criminal, but he's the criminal with heart that we kind of like have empathy for, especially at the, even if you don't have empathy for the film still tries to convey that, like, oh, he's sorry, which, you know, we'll get to later, which is why I picked the other 1947 film. But, and then, you know, the first guy who doesn't make it, he's kind of like the dummy, you know, it's that classic, like, group of burglars. If you go to just anyone, even, you know, it's funny, I was reading up, I was trying to do some Google searching, a little bit of research on this, and I was like searching Quentin Tarantino's name alongside this movie, because there's, you know, we all know, whatever, Reservoir Dogs is similar to that other, you know, Asian film, but I just wanted to know if, like, especially when it comes to Asian films, specifically Japanese films, you know, Tarantino is never, say what you want about him. I have plenty to say about him, not the nicest things. But this movie remind, it was like a cross between, it was like Reservoir Dogs and Hateful Eight. Just the fact, like, the whole idea of Hateful Eight, these people being snuck in a snowstorm. There's a little bit of tension. Not everybody knows everything about each other. Like, you know, like, some are criminals, some aren't criminals, like that whole deal. And then the whole thing with Reservoir Dogs is you have this group of guys, but at least in Reservoir Dogs, you get a backstory for most, you know, for most of the people. But I didn't find anything. It wouldn't surprise me if Tarantino saw this movie, but I was certain that he had seen this and, you know, but I guess not. Huh. But going back to what you said, yeah, you know, sure, I guess it's such a short film, so you're not going to get a lot of backstory. But then, you know, as I'm talking, you know, at the same time, Reservoir Dogs isn't exactly a long movie, but you still get, you know, at least with Harvey Keitel, Michael Madsen, Tim Roth, you see the kind of vague, the aftermath of the burglary. You see, you know, them hiding out, similar to just like how the characters in this movie hide out, and then there's the big shootout at the end. So, I don't know. I guess maybe if some things could have been reworked and taken out and trimmed down, or if the movie was a little bit longer, you could have got a little bit of a little more meat, a little more backstory on some of these characters, especially Shamira mm-hmm. and Mifune. But, you know.
Yeah, like it. I like it overall, but it definitely. I don't know. It's kind of middle of the road. Like the third act, I think, is great. In the middle act. The second act, when they're in this cooped up in the hotel, it's like it kind of goes on for a little too long for me.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm not gonna disagree with that. Like, again, I think that's something that could have, yeah, it could have been trimmed down, and then, you know, maybe the film could have been restructured, and we could have got like how these guys even like met and stuck together and all that stuff. You know,
yeah, like you're given no reason as to like how they met or why they stuck together exactly. So it just kind of feels like Mifune being an alpha male and deciding to take control is kind of, it almost felt kind of random.
Yeah. Yes.
But I got kind of a noir feeling. Like it feels like a Kurosawa wrote the script for this. Because mm-hmm. there were, like, in the 40s, he was still writing scripts that he wasn't producing. Not as many as you'd think, but there are a few that's available on Criterion and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, it feels like Kurosawa is going with, like, a more Hollywood, trying to make a Hollywood, like, a noir-type movie, because...
Yeah, I was gonna say it's somewhere between a noir and like a caper, like a crime heist or post crime heist, you know, film. Just like it, to me, yeah, this is just like a Sunday afternoon movie.
Yes,
like something. Oh, I'll just turn someone that would be on like Turner Classic Movies, like that kind of vibe, where it's not like, oh, I'm expecting to be blown away, but I'm also not expecting for anything to be bad. It's kind of in the middle. In the middle, but I mean that positively, as weird as that may sound.
Yeah, like, it's, it kind of reminds me of, what is it, Treasure of Sierra Madre?
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a while since I've seen that, but for some reason, I just kept going, my mind kept going back to Treasure of Sierra Madre is kind of like a version of this, but if it was set in a hotter place, and it feels like, a lesser version of Treasure of Sierra Madre, based off what I remember.
Oh, damn. I didn't even think about that. That's a cool comparison.
Yeah, and that's John Huston?
Yes, it is. Okay.
Yeah, classic Hollywood is not my forte, so I...
Yeah, I'm kind of I'm up and down with that. I have a good friend of mine who's big into the classic Hollywood. And also... my dad, he was big into, like, the classic Hollywood stuff, especially, like, John Huston films and stuff like that, so. And also going back to the kind of, like, discovery of Kurosawa films and just certain Japanese films. My dad was big into Westerns, or as he would call them, cowboy movies. And, you know, we've all heard, you know, everyone knows at this point a lot of the classic samurai films were reworked, you know, as Westerns and stuff. So that was also a little kind of impromptu education that I got.
Yeah,
on that stuff.
Yeah, at what point did you realize Fistful of Dollars was just Yojimbo?
Well, I knew, like, this is one of those things where, like, I got into these films later on in the game, so it's one of those things where I read about before actually seeing it, so it wasn't anything I discovered on my own in my late teens, early 20s.
Oh, okay.
So, what was I going to say? Yeah, going back to the Tarantino thing, I was really disappointed. I was, like, really searching. I was just like, did anyone make this correlation between, like, two of his films? And not just that, too. Like, there's also this kind of, like, you know, whether it's John Carpenter or the one that came before, like, The Thing. I am a little fascinated by just the whole, like, being snowed in. But then at some point it's like, oh, we got to go back outside. You know, we got to do this.
Well,
what's
the thing was, Who Goes There, that short story.
Exactly. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Well, I don't know if this movie made it out of Japan at the time.
Right.
For some reason, like, I don't think that many Japanese movies at this point were going outside Japan. I think Rashomon was kind of the open the floodgates for that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I feel like this might be just coincidence.
Yeah, have you also seen? I guess we'll get into it at some point. But like the way just my brain works, especially the older I get, you know, with cinema, I pay attention and I take the film as its own thing, but then I'm just big into comparisons. Like, if you follow me on Twitter, if you go to my site, I'm always into comparing films. Half the time it's me just pulling stuff out of my ass, but then other times it's just reading a lot of books and reading, like, a younger generation of filmmakers literally saying, like, hey, I wanted to rip this scene off, or I wanted to do this just like that movie. And, you know, so anyway, what I'm getting at is, are you familiar with any of Larry Fessenden's films?
I know the name, but I don't know if I've seen anything.
It's funny. Well, I guess to some people, I guess the demographic of folks who listen to the show, Larry Fessenden, he's also an actor sometimes too. Larry Fessenden, he's the guy that punches Bill Murray in the face in Broken Flowers.
Oh, that Jarmusch.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
But Larry Fessenden, he's also a filmmaker. He's good friends with Kelly Reichardt. Anyway, in 2006, he directed this film. I think IFC Films put it out, called The Last Winter.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar to, more in line with Carpenter's The Thing, but it's also similar to this film, to Snow Trail, where it's like there's not really a criminal aspect, and it's also kind of a horror film, but it's still that, like, that it's that story of just like people being snowed in, something's going on, but then they also at some point they have to make a venture out of this hut. They have to leave this kind of protected area and venture out into the snow. You know, I mean, there's lots of movies like that, but these are just some of the films that kind of like came into my mind. You know, I think I was mostly reminded because, you know, the climax or the last third of the film is very similar to The Last Winter, where it's like, oh, it's not so much we just have to bear the snow, we have to put ourselves in like really dangerous, you know, in a dangerous setting. We don't really know what we're doing, you know. And that's another thing too about this film too. Snow Trail. Just little details. When who's the character? Is it Honda? Who's like an expert? You know, mountain man. Just like if you look at, you know, the little details of like how he ties certain knots and like tying them all together, the snowshoes, you know, it's little things like that. And it's not just like, oh, they're wearing snowshoes. There's a lot of shots of the camera where it just zooms in on their feet, and it zooms in when they're in a dangerous position, like how he's gripping with the hooks on his shoes and things like that. So while, yeah, this is just like a casual, like I said earlier, a casual kind of like a Sunday afternoon movie, there's still some cool little details in the film, you know, as well.
Yeah, and like Mr. Honda, like at one point he's it's like, I think it's sort of the middle of the third act where he's like, I think Shimura asked him, why didn't you just cut him off earlier? He said, I can't, it's a mountaineer's honor. It's your duty. You climb the mountain. You don't violate that code.
Yeah, which is funny because the code of criminals comes up at one point too. Because like he doesn't want to who is it here? Hold on, I had the I just want to say everyone's names right. Yeah, you have Nijiro. You know, after Honda gets hurt, Nijiro doesn't want to leave him behind. And then, you know, Ijima or Mifune kind of like mocks him, like, and he's just like, oh, honor among thieves kind of thing. So there is that kind of interesting contrast where, like, the code of, like, honor among thieves comes up, and then, like, the honor among, you know, like, Honda. So I thought that was kind of cool also.
Yeah.
It's not like I have anything negative to say about it too much. I mean, if anything, and even what I'm picking up from you, the negative criticism is, I just wanted more, which is, in my opinion, I think is a good criticism. Like, I think that's mostly what I'm getting from you, and then I kind of feel the same way. It's like, I wanted a little more, maybe longer, or maybe rework certain things and take certain things out and expand on other stuff that, you know, that wasn't. I think that's, if a filmmaker ever heard a criticism, I feel like that's kind of the criticism that they'd want to hear.
This isn't the first time Kurosawa worked with, well, he didn't actually make it, but this isn't the first time he dealt with snow in his third film, Sanshiro Sugata Part 2, which is one of his propaganda films, which is kind of interesting. You get some really great judo fighting in it, and it's like, for a 40s movie, the action is surprisingly really good, and the big climax of Sanshiro Sugata Part 2 is the end fight. It's the two actors fighting in the snow, and they're actually, it's actually during a snowstorm, and they're just flipping each other around in the snow, and they're like barefoot with no gloves and everything, and it's pretty insane when you consider the fact of, like, they're in a snowstorm with almost no protection at all, and it just feels like the third act is almost kind of like taking, like, the final act of Sugata Part 2 with the snow and just expanding into, it's not just like a cool judo fight in the snow. This is going to be three people climbing a mountain, and I'm trying to find something deeper here.
Sure. And maybe it's not there. The movie just kind of, it is what it is. Like, what are we doing? A solid 3 out of 5, or if you want to be so, you know, if you want to start grading movies.
Yeah, and like the cinematography towards the end with like the mountain climb was really intense.
And you know, I'm seeing too in a couple of and just doing a little, you know, like I said, some basic research, I'm seeing Akira Kurosawa was uncredited as far as editing it as well.
Interesting.
I'm seeing that in a few places. So, and like I said, it's that combination of the cinematography and the editing, both, that got me to notice those little details of mountain climbing and snow climbing that, you know, I mentioned a few minutes ago.
I just thought of it, but it kind of also reminds me of the Stallone movie Cliffhanger.
Of course.
I'm not sure which is better, this or Cliffhanger. Both are pretty entertaining.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like some Japanese cinema fans will be mad at me, but I guess I don't want to say anything only because I know Cliffhanger much better, because I've seen that a lot more than I've seen this. So, and one movie, Cliffhanger, is a little more ingrained in my mind than this. Like, you know, Snow Trail is relatively new. You know, I watched it for the first time a little while back, and then I watched it last night again, and then today I was just like looking up a couple of scenes as well. So it's kind of a new movie for me.
I just found my notes, the Kentucky song about, what was that, like Dixie Confederate
song that the little girl plays.
I like that little touch, because that's at this point during the occupation. I'm not sure if you know about like the censorship with the occupation, but during that point, the Japanese directors were not allowed to put any samurai or any of their own history that would glorify their history in their movies, because out of fear of nationalism and rebellion, because MacArthur kind of ruled basically like a dictator when he was over there, and they were not allowed to mention the atomic bombings at all. That'd be get your movie banned. and it was bombings, and you could not talk about or bring up Americans either. But they're always.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Again, I don't mean to cut you off, but when you mention MacArthur and his relationship to Japan, have you seen the film The Son?
The son? No, but Joel will be on Russophiles Unite podcast talking about that movie, actually.
Oh man. Well, it's great. It's directed by Alexander Sakharov, who I love very, very, very much. I think it was the last. Yeah, it was the last part of a trilogy that he made. The first film was about Lenin. The second film was about Adolf Hitler, and this film is about Hirohito, post World War II. And there's like towards the end, it's like this big meeting, this like underground meeting between him and MacArthur. So you saying that just reminded me. I know we're trying to stick to 1947. This movie came out in 2005, but you or anyone listening, it's a really good movie. Actually, all three films in the trilogy, Moloch, Taurus, and The Son, they're all really good. But I think the Son kind of ties into particularly what you're talking about. Now you bring up that history and whatnot.
Yeah, like what movie broke it? I think Gojira was the first movie back to come out after the ban was lifted, or one of them. Because what was it? Because like Mizoguchi could get away with like historical stuff because he would make it about like the struggle of women, and so therefore it's not too nationalistic. But like with, I think Rashomon was kind of like that helped break down the barriers a little bit because there was some sword fighting in that. But it's just a real bizarre time because like MacArthur was in some ways kind of really shitty. And I'll like bring it up, have a, can bring it up later actually. But usually Joel and I would compare the two films, but there kind of isn't that much to compare. Where One Wonderful Sunday is this, on the surface looks like kind of like a Kurosawa rom-com, but there's actually a lot more going on about gender politics and like sexual politics, and it's kind of secretly one of Kurosawa's best movies, but it kind of a lot of people don't think of it because it's not Samurai or Mifune, so it's kind of gets overlooked unfairly, but it definitely is worth watching. And if you ever, well, in my case, I found it weirdly too realistic because it's about a young couple who are poor who just want to find a place together. Well, on the surface, it's about this young couple who just want to find a place together and get married, and they're poor and they can only spend Sundays together. And there's a scene of them trying to find an apartment, and it's like, man, that's just hitting too close to home right now. This is uncomfortable. Because like all the stuff with like, oh, the landlord sucks. You can't have pets. It's too hot in the summer. And it's like, that's every fucking apartment we've been looking at. But yeah. If you watch it, you could probably really relate to certain aspects, being like young and in your 20s and back to that era. If, but compared to Snow Trail, there's not really much to talk about besides this Kurosawa connection with screenwriter. And that's kind of it. And yeah, so do you have any 1947 movies?
I do. So Monsieur Verdot, I've always been fascinated by this movie. I saw this movie there's a years ago. There's this theater downtown New York City in the East Village called Anthology Film Archives, and it was kind of my second home for a while. And it is by it's actually a story. It's similar to like so. So there's a couple of interesting connections. I'm all about my movie connections, and there's a couple of reasons why I picked this movie. as it pertains to Snow Trail, in that just like how Snow Trail, it was a story or a screenplay by Kurosawa, but he didn't direct it. Monsieur Verdot was directed by Charlie Chaplin. He also starred in it, but it was a story. It was based on a story from Orson Welles. I mean, it's actually kind of based on a true story about this guy.
Mm-hmm. Is it a comedy?
He was okay. Well, yeah, it is. But then it's also not, because it's kind of like, oh, wait a minute, this is really messed up. Because basically, the character, the main character, Monsieur Verdot, played by Charlie Chaplin, he's kind of this, like, this criminal that you kind of feel sympathetic towards, because in the end of both movies, the end of Monsieur Verdot and the end of, you know, Snow Trail, we're left with these two criminals who, you know, the film, the language, the vibe, the ambiance of the film is kind of directing us to feel sorry for these guys and to feel empathy for them. But what Monsieur Verdot does is way worse. He's basically this out-of-work bank teller, so he gets with and marries rich women and then kills them for their money. But then it's weird because it's like, oh, he was a bank teller and he just got the shaft, and he has his daughter in a wheelchair. Like, there's all these tropes where you kind of feel sorry. And, you know, at the end of the movie, he gives this impassioned speech about, you know, the rich versus the poor. And all that's true, but then it's like, but wait, you killed rich women to take their money. It's really, yeah, it's, and as you can imagine, like, the movie, it's not one of his, like, tramp movies. Mm-hmm. When it came out, as you can imagine, there were a lot of protests, a lot of people were very against it, because this guy is the good guy at the end of the day. And it's a comedy. Like, there's typical Charlie Chaplin-esque moments where it's like he's trying to creep up behind one of his current wives who's rich, who he's trying to kill so he can get her money. And it's like, there's one scene where on the boat and he's trying to kill her while she has his head turned, and then she turns real quick, and then he plays it off like, oh, I'm not trying to kill you. But it's like a comedy. Like, it's supposed to be funny. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So again, like, I don't support the politics of it, but it's a really interesting, messy movie. And the older I get, messy movies like that are the most fascinating. Going back to just, you know, not a 1947 movie, but, you know, The Sun and all those movies in that trilogy, like Taurus and Malick, are very messy films, and I highly recommend all of those. But to keep it with 1947, yeah, Monsieur Verdot, directed and starring Charlie Chaplin. Mm-hmm. In a story adapted from Orson Welles.
Huh. Yeah. On your messy movies, I really love messy movies. Like, a movie that I'm pretty obsessed with is Ralph Bakshi's Coonskin, which is...
Oh, man, yeah.
It's like his masterpiece, but it's so bizarre and messy, and it's like...
You could say that.
And it's like, why are you trying to comment on race relations? I don't think you have a, like, everyone has a say in it, but it's kind of awkward when Ralph Bakshi is like, I want to talk about Black America.
Yeah, and it's not even so much just Ralph Bakshi. It's just like, I come over the years, like, people who like that movie, mostly white men, are super opinionated about it, and I do sometimes worry that it's like, oh, I've seen Coonskin, so I'm down. I know what's going on. Like, that, it's that kind of thing. That like, those kind of fans of that movie, which so far in my own personal life experiences, those seem to be the majority of fans of that movie. You know, and there's nothing I dislike more than being a black person and having a white person try to tell me about blackness. That's kind of the worst thing anyway. I don't want to hear it, but but that movie in particular, yeah, it's very problematic, but it's also just like,
it's just like,
weirdly should be seen.
Yeah, like, you know? I'm black too, and like, I just find like anything that's evoking minstrelsy, that's not like a 40s like Hollywood racist thing, to be like really fascinating, just how like minstrelsy and blackface get used.
Yeah.
Like, that's part of why I love Spike Lee's Bamboozled. It's my favorite Spike Lee movie, even though
it's top three. It's top three for me. And just in keeping in line, it's a very, very messy movie. Oh, like, that movie is far from perfect. Like, there's some things in that movie that are not cool and that are not like, but overall, it's just like, I think that movie, it's like a misunderstood, messy masterpiece.
Yeah, like, it's just, I love Spike Lee, and of course I love Do the Right Thing, and Crooklyn, sure. And like, Jungle
Fever. I'm a Clockers guy. I love that movie.
I haven't gotten that one yet, but like, this Bamboozled was the one that made me go like, oh, holy shit, Spike Lee is just, he's the master, but he's still not perfect when you stretch, but the, I don't know, like, that movie is just, well, actually, after Kurosawa, Joe and I are moving on to Spike Lee.
Oh, awesome. Well, I wanted to say, anytime I get any kind of platform to talk, and the timing is right, I like to plug this movie. Have you seen his light reworking of Ganja and Hess, The Sweet Blood of Jesus?
I love Ganja and Hess so much, I'm very nervous about it, but because we're going to do a podcast on Spike Lee next, I will...
Mm-hmm.
I will watch it, and then I'm really scared.
Honestly, as far as like a modern ish, not that Ganja and Hess is like some old movie, but Spike Lee does keep in tune and really kind of does that movie. He does it justice, but more so he does it with respect. Like he pays homage, like. That you could almost do like shot for shot comparisons between like there's certain specific moments just like where you know the main character you know the guy's getting ready to get stabbed while he's sleeping and then that whole fight ensues the guy sitting in the tree like there's some really just like okay he and Bill Gunn is just kind of the man right now like out here in New York City they're showing they're going to be showing Ganja and Hess at a couple of theaters coming up. Also, prior to that, I saw for the first time, I saw Bill Gunn's other film, Personal Problems.
Did he direct that?
Yes, he did. It was this like movie that he shot on tape. Yeah, it's masterful. It's also kind of messy, too. It's a messy, really good masterpiece, you know, of a film. But it was this movie that kind of got like forgotten about, and it was like rediscovered. And I'm pretty sure... they're going to roll out the Blu-ray and DVD at some point because it's doing all the rounds at all the repertory theaters, which is usually what happens. Like, they play the movies at you know, all the different, like, theaters, and then it comes out in a nice, you know, a nice release. But, yeah, Personal Problems is great, as is Ganja and Hess. But I think... I don't know you well at all, but if you love Ganja and Hess as much as you say, I don't think you're gonna dislike The Sweet Blood of Jesus like I can kind of hear in your voice.
All I know is that Mr. Robot is in it. That guy, whatever.
He doesn't have a big role. No. He's just like a star. I mean, he's in it from start to finish. But oh yeah, Rami Malek. He's a butler.
Oh.
He's like a supporting guy. He's always there in the movie, but he doesn't have like a huge significant like role or anything.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, rolling back to other 1947 movies.
Sure.
I just have one.
Okay.
I haven't finished Black Narcissus, but I really like it so far. I have an hour left because of work and lately I haven't yet. Had time to finish it, but I did watch the Jacques Tati short film School. I think it's called School for Postmen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the School for Postmen, which is basically a prequel to his, I think, was his debut film, The Big Day, which if you like slapstick and Jacques Tati, like. He's basically the French Charlie Chaplin.
Sure.
Have you seen any Tati films?
Oh, of course. Playtime, Traffic, My Uncle. Yeah, plenty. Yeah. Again, he's another guy that I really know mainly through Criterion, but I'm very familiar. I guess I'm really familiar with Tati also because in just my movie watching and personal research, I do find a lot of visual similarities from Tati's films in, you know, films that, like, more modern films, like a guy like Hal Hartley, certain Hal Hartley films, specifically, like, the Long Island films, I see quite a bit of Tati in his movies. If you watch, you know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, there's quite a bit of, like, old Jacques Tati in Pee-wee's Big Adventure as well, so I guess I'm kind of fascinated with him through my perceived influence that he's had on young filmmakers that came after him.
Yeah, what I've seen, which is just this and The Short and The Big Day, I really like.
Oh, you haven't seen like the other stuff?
Not yet. But
oh, it's good. It's good. It's fun stuff. It's the same. I'm not gonna say, mm-hmm. Oh, if you've seen one, you've seen them all. But it's like there's a continuous thread through most of his movies where it's like, oh, if you like these, then you'll like those.
Yeah, I know Joel's not here to poo-poo it because Joel, he doesn't like to watch comedies in general.
Oh, jeez. You gotta. I mean,
I
gotta watch comedies. Oh man.
Well. The only comedies we've really covered is The Pornographers by Emma Mora, which if you've seen that, that's a really dark, fucked up family drama, but it's Emma Mora, so it's actually, it's really funny, but then you feel bad about what you're laughing at. Yeah.
Sure. Well, that's the sign of a true dark comedy.
Yeah, like...
Where you laugh and like, oh, wait, wait a minute. Which is why, not so much anymore, but I remember when I was in my late teens, early 20s, like, I loved Todd Solondz. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still like, I think Welcome to the Dollhouse is, I think that, like, the, you know, whatever you want to call it, Generation Y, or, like, the first class of millennials to be born in the early 80s, I like to claim Welcome to the Dollhouse for us. But happiness and storytelling also, it's like, really messed up shit happens in his movies, but you're supposed to laugh. But then it's like, oh, wait a minute, I shouldn't be laughing at this. But the tone of the movie suggests that I laugh. But
yeah,
so I like a good dark comedy.
Yeah, Emma Moore is really good. A lot of his stuff is on Criterion. I recommend Pornographers first, could get a taste of like the real dark, political and social stuff he was doing at the time. And, sure. Like, incest is a common joke topic, and he keeps going back to that, yet every time it's like, oh, this is really funny, but I feel awful about laughing about this really horrible situation. Oh, yeah, so you got stuff to plug.
Always. I have a podcast with my good friend and film score composer Scott Thoreau. It's called Zebras in America. We're in our second year, and you know, recently we've been interviewing some really cool filmmakers. We just at the time whenever this episode drops, the most recent episode will be our interview with Ryan Prowse, who directed this really great film called Low Life that was put out by IFC Films. Mm-hmm. I can't speak highly of that movie enough, but the other thing I wanted to plug my site, Pinland Empire, pinlandempire.com. I wrote a piece on Low Life, and the director of the film, Ryan Prowse, saw it. He liked it, and then I asked, hey, do you want to come on the show? And he just came on the show last week, and we talked about, you know, everything. So, Zebras in America, Pinland Empire, by the time this episode comes out, my June content will be up. Mm-hmm. I'm starting things off tomorrow. I'm posting my piece on, my first piece of many on Chantal Ackerman's influence on filmmakers like Jim Jarmusch, Todd Haynes, Aki Kaurismäki, Richard Linklater, Michael Haneke, you know, folks like that. I love Ackerman, and we cover her quite a bit. I cover her quite a bit on my site. Go to the Pink Smoke. I like to consider myself the third mic of the Pink Smoke. Mm-hmm. I wrote something. It's not going to actually be posted until July because Pink Smoke has a really big month of June. That's really it's going to be focusing on your past guest Martin Kessler. Mm-hmm. did some really good he went in on Alexei German, so the Pink Smoke is going to kind of be dedicated to Martin Kessler's work and his writing on Alexei German coming up in June. So Zebras in America, Pinland Empire, Pink Smoke, and all my other podcast appearances. I'm on The Wrong Reel all the time. I'm on FlixWise quite regularly, and various other podcasts, you know, as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's see. For me, my movie blog, Jailhouse 701, Japanese Cult Cinema. This comes out in late June, so by this point, I'll have at least two of the Chiba movies I'm going to cover for Chiba Checkup, because I have not seen much Sonny Chiba movies, so I'm using this as an excuse to watch some Sonny Chiba movies. And nice. I like what I've seen so far, and I bought like a foreign movie pack for $2 or something on Amazon. So I was like, I have an excuse to watch these now.
Oh, is it the one? It's like 10 movies in one?
No, it was just four. It's
Oh,
the
okay.
box was messed up, and but the discs are fine. It's
Okay.
like $2. So I don't really care. But
Cool.
yeah, Chiba Checkup, and earlier in I think in January, I did an article there about the Rika trilogy, this Pinky Violence trilogy about Pinky Violence, like the jailhouse, like female Prisoner Scorpion series, Stray Cat Rock series, that type of stuff. This lesser known Pinky Violence series called Rika, and it's about a girl who is half American, half Japanese, and her gang and her like exploits and stuff. And it's pretty much about like what happened to the generation of kids who were born out of rape during the McCarthy, not McCarthy, during the MacArthur reign in
Wow.
Japan. Because it kind of really goes back to like how MacArthur treated rape of Japanese women, which I write about in an article about the series as a whole. And it's good. It's
Oh,
just
cool.
kind of
Very
really
cool.
dark because MacArthur
Sh
did some
sure, sure.
bad shit when he was in control. But there's that. I was on FlixWise Canada talking about The Rot, this great African film that.
It's a really good, yeah, it's a great episode.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Well, I'm a fan of that film.
Oh, you've exactly seen it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It played at, again, I think this is like the third time now I've mentioned Film Forum, but over the years, Film Forum, I feel like of any theater in New, repertory theater or art house theater, whatever you want to call it, in New York City, I feel like Film Forum is like the kindest to African cinema, both old classic and like present day African film, like the whole continent. So,
Oh, great. Oh, man, I want to go to New York now.
yeah.
I think that the director, Mohamed Salah Haroun, did a thing there because there's a video on YouTube of some showing of one of his movies with Ellis Mitchell hosting.
Oh, cool.
It's from, like, maybe 5 years ago or something. Anyways, so yeah, I was on FlixWise talking about Darat, which I think is a perfect film. It's a movie I still think about every day. It starts out like a revenge movie, but then it takes a turn into something totally different. And it's streaming on Amazon. I have the Region 2 DVD. It's not on Region 1 DVD at all, which really sucks, but that's a problem with African movies. They're not available in America, really.
Well, it's and you know, it's funny too that, you know, only recently, I guess Martin, now that, you know, in retrospect, Martin was prepping for this episode because he started posting these movie comparisons between Darat and Star Wars, which kind of blew my mind. Like, as someone who's big into movie comparisons, a lot of stuff can be forced and it can be generic and vague, but some of the stuff that Martin was coming up with was really like, oh, holy shit,
Oh
you
yeah,
know?
it's really shocking how similar certain scenes are to Star Wars in this movie. Like it kind of covers the whole trilogy, the whole original trilogy, actually, with the comparisons. But Martin joked it's a low-key remake of the first Star Wars movie.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
Absolutely.
it's 1951's The Idiot, which was Kurosawa's adaptation of the Dostoevsky novel, and that's paired with Repast? Something like that. All I know, it's I think it's Kinoshita, who was a lesser known director at the time, who kind of still doesn't get his due, unfortunately. And Repast, I think, has Setsuko Hara in that, and The Idiot also stars Setsuko Hara.
Oh, cool. Very cool.
And The Idiot original cut was 4.5 hours, and Toho made him cut it down to 2 hours, 45 minutes.
Wow.
And all that last footage is gone forever, unfortunately. But, yeah, that will be with Alistair Pitts from Russo Files Unite. He's coming back because it's Russian, and therefore he has to be on because it's Russian. And,
right.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, that's it. And you can listen to the tag for all that other stuff. Marcus, thank you for your time.
Hey, thank you for having me. This is really fun.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. The show's Twitter is @highandlowpod. The show can be found on Facebook under the title of High and Low, a Curacao podcast. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Podbean. We are no longer on Podient. Thank you for listening. Scam the man, the master plan, hot damn. We don't need no pots and pans to fry them, cause ain't no buckle of mine that's named Sam. And ain't no trouble of mine, we make jams to inspire your bubble of mind. Get gems, the melanin elements never settle for the less. Incredible presence getting great with each breath. We just trying to melanin, we just wanna elevate.